This is Audible.
Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Innovator's Dilemma, When New Technologies Cause Great Firms to Fail, by Clayton M. Christensen. Read by L.J. Ganser. Preface. In 1990, I began asking the two questions that would eventually help shape this book. First, why is success so difficult to sustain? And second, is successful innovation really as unpredictable as the data suggests? By that time, I'd been a strategist at the Boston Consulting Group, where I'd had unusual opportunities to see at every level how companies competed. And I had co-founded CPS Technologies to commercialize advanced materials technology developed in MIT labs. But neither career path had yet to fully answer those two questions that were keeping me up at night. So, at 38, with the support of my wife, and months before our fifth child was born, I became a doctoral student and made those questions my life's work. I'm happy to say I got the answer to the first, and with the continued help of tremendous colleagues drawn to the subject over the last two decades, I'm still homing in on the second. In this new edition of The Innovator's Dilemma, I'll show you some of the exciting new research we've conducted since the book was first published two decades ago. Why is success so difficult to sustain? This was and still is an important question, because when you look across the sweep of business history, most companies that once seemed successful, the best practitioners of best practice, were in the middle of the pack, or worse, the back of it, a decade or two later. And we discovered something unsettling and counterintuitive. What often causes this lagging behind are two principles of good management taught in business schools: that you should always listen to and respond to the needs of your best customers, and that you should focus investments on those innovations that promise the highest returns. But these two principles, in practice, actually sow the seeds of every successful company's ultimate demise. That's why we call it the innovator's dilemma. Doing the right thing is the wrong thing. This dilemma rears its head when a type of innovation that we've termed disruptive technology arises at the low end of the market, in the simplest, most unassuming applications. Explaining this paradox is the purpose of this book. Incidentally, another scholar who subsequently joined me in the study of this phenomenon, Michael Rayner of Deloitte Research, has noted that disruptive technology is probably the cause behind the creative destruction that economist Joseph Schumpeter observed to be the primary engine of economic progress more than half a century ago. I think Michael is right. And what about that second question, the one about successful innovation really being as unpredictable as the data suggests? Here's an illustration that I think helps show what I mean. All venture capitalists convince themselves, to various degrees, that the companies they're investing in will succeed. Otherwise, they wouldn't invest in them in the first place, right? But they are correct in only 10 to 20% of the investments they make. So they have structured their whole industry on hedging their bets against the alleged unpredictability of innovation. The amounts of their financial commitments, for example, vary greatly, depending on statistical assessments of the risks involved. The track record of innovators inside established companies is roughly the same. But think about it. If we could determine that innovation is inherently unpredictable, and not just a risk to manage like venture capitalists do, then it would lead us down a very different path. And research done by my colleagues and me seems to be indicating that this is in fact the case. For example, before World War II, if you were in the business of drilling for oil, 90% of the wells you drilled would be dry. Just like a venture capitalist's, your instincts told you there might be oil in those places, but you spent 90% of your working life drilling dry holes. In the subsequent 75 years, however, geological researchers have developed theories that tell them what data to seek about structures deep in the earth, and those theories help them give meaning to that data. Now they can predict with much more accuracy whether oil is present before they start drilling. There's no guaranteed guide to oil drilling yet, but today, over 60% of the wells drilled strike oil. Today, my colleagues and I are striving to bring to innovators, entrepreneurs, and the people who invest in them the same kinds of useful theories that those geologists brought to oil drilling. We want to help them know which pieces of information they need to collect and how to interpret that information so that they can become predictably successful at a rate that wasn't possible in the past. And I'm thrilled to report that since this book was first published, we have made substantial progress with these theories. It might seem audacious to assert that hard-headed, data-driven, results-oriented managers can benefit from using theories. Indeed, the terms theory and theoretical connote impractical in modern business speak. But theories are statements of cause and effect, which actions yield which results and why. As such, a good theory is consummately practical. The truth is, every time managers take an action or make a plan, they do it with the belief that if they take the actions they envision, they'll get the results they need. So managers are in fact voracious consumers of theory. The problem, the reason why succeeding at innovation has seemed so unpredictable, is that researchers to date haven't provided a body of theory that is valid and reliable enough to give innovators a solid sense of whether there is oil down there before they start drilling. Some who have read this book have been bothered that the examples I used to illustrate the effects of disruption are all drawn from the past. But perhaps that's because those readers have been misled as to what theory actually is and how it is built. Let me explain. Data only exists about the past. Theory must be derived, therefore, from careful observation of the past, then by categorizing those observations and correlating those categories with the outcomes of interest. Then, by understanding what causes those outcomes, and finally by showing how that causal mechanism can produce different results in different circumstances, theory is then improved by using it to predict, retrospectively, to predict what should have happened in the past, and prospectively, to predict what will happen in the future. That being said, the theory of disruption continues to yield predictions that are quite accurate in an astounding range of industries and applications, from satellites and national defense to computers and telecommunications, from retailing software to national economic development, and from healthcare to education. Hundreds of students, consultants, investors, executives, and academics have joined with me to continue testing the theory of disruption and to research the problems of innovation. In many ways, this book has become a common platform of understanding upon which we have gathered, and I'm incapable of expressing how grateful I am for all they have taught me since the first publication of this book. I can think of no professional pursuit more rewarding than joining with such kind, selfless, and intelligent people in the pursuit of light and truth. Countless articles and books have been written on this shared platform. I invite you to dig into this body of work, some of which is listed under my name on the Harvard Business School website. In doing so, I hope you will notice that The Innovator's Dilemma, published 2 decades ago, is the last piece for which I was the sole author. All subsequent scholarship has been with dozens of wonderful colleagues, a tribute to how greatly so many people have contributed to this body of understanding we have been working to build. The great historian of science, Thomas Kuhn, taught us that the key to improving any theory is to surface anomalies, events or phenomena that the theory cannot explain. It is only by seeking to account for outliers, exceptions to the theory, that researchers can improve the theory. That's why I need you to join me as a researcher. After you've read this book, put the theory of disruption on like a set of lenses and search for things in your past and present experience for which the theory cannot yet account. Then let me know about the anomalies so that we can get to work improving the theory to resolve them. Clayton M. Christensen, Kim B. Clark, Professor of Business Administration, Harvard Business School. Introduction. This book is about the failure of companies to stay atop their industries when they confront certain types of market and technological change. It's not about the failure of simply any company, but of good companies, the kinds that many managers have admired and tried to emulate, the companies known for their abilities to innovate and execute. Companies stumble for many reasons, of course, among them bureaucracy, arrogance, tired executive blood, poor planning, short-term investment horizons, inadequate skills and resources, and just plain bad luck. But this book is not about companies with such weaknesses. It is about well-managed companies that have their competitive antennae up, listen astutely to their customers, invest aggressively in new technologies, and yet still lose market dominance. Such seemingly unaccountable failures happen in industries that move fast and in those that move slow, in those built on electronics technology and those built on chemical and mechanical technology, in manufacturing and in service industries. Sears Roebuck, for example, was regarded for decades as one of the most astutely managed retailers in the world. At its zenith, Sears accounted for more than 2% of all retail sales in the United States. It pioneered several innovations critical to the success of today's most admired retailers. For example, supply chain management, store brands, catalog retailing, and credit card sales. The esteem in which Sears management was held shows in this 1964 excerpt from Fortune. How did Sears do it? In a way, the most arresting aspect of its story is that there was no gimmick. Sears opened no big bag of tricks, shot off no skyrockets. Instead, it looked as though everybody in its organization simply did the right thing, easily and naturally. And their cumulative effect was to create an extraordinary powerhouse of a company. Yet no one speaks about Sears that way today. Somehow, it completely missed the advent of discount retailing and home centers. In the midst of today's catalog retailing boom, Sears has been driven from that business. Indeed, the very viability of its retailing operations has been questioned. One commentator has noted that Sears Merchandise Group lost $1.3 billion in 1992, even before a $1.7 billion restructuring charge. Sears let arrogance blind it to basic changes taking place in the American marketplace. Another writer has complained, Sears has been a disappointment for investors who have watched its stock sink dismally in the face of unkept promises of a turnaround. Sears' old merchandising approach, a vast, middle-of-the-road array of mid-priced goods and services, is no longer competitive. No question, the constant disappointments, the repeated predictions of a turnaround that never seems to come, have reduced the credibility of Sears management in both the financial and merchandising communities. It is striking to note that Sears received its accolades at exactly the time, in the mid-1960s, when it was ignoring the rise of discount retailing and home centers, the lower-cost formats for marketing name-brand hard goods that ultimately stripped Sears of its core franchise. Sears was praised as one of the best-managed companies in the world at the very time it let Visa and MasterCard usurp the enormous lead it had established in the use of credit cards in retailing. In some industries, this pattern of leadership failure has been repeated more than once. Consider the computer industry. IBM dominated the mainframe market, but missed by years the emergence of mini-computers, which were technologically much simpler than mainframes. In fact, no other major manufacturer of mainframe computers became a significant player in the mini-computer business. Digital Equipment Corporation created the mini-computer market and was joined by a set of other aggressively managed companies, Data General, Prime, Wang, Hewlett-Packard, and Nixdorf. But each of these companies in turn missed the desktop personal computer market. It was left to Apple Computer, together with Commodore, Tandy, and IBM's standalone PC division to create the personal computing market. Apple, in particular, was uniquely innovative in establishing the standard for user-friendly computing. But Apple and IBM lagged 5 years behind the leaders in bringing portable computers to market. Similarly, the firms that built the engineering workstation market, Apollo, Sun, and Silicon Graphics, were all newcomers to the industry. As in retailing, many of these leading computer manufacturers were at one time regarded as among the best-managed companies in the world, and were held up by journalists and scholars of management as examples for all to follow. Consider this assessment of Digital Equipment, made in 1986. Taking on Digital Equipment Corporation these days is like standing in front of a moving train. The $7.6 billion computer maker has been gathering speed, while most rivals are stalled in a slump in the computer industry. The author proceeded to warn IBM to watch out, because it was standing on the tracks. Indeed, Digital was one of the most prominently featured companies in the McKinsey study that led to the book In Search of Excellence. Yet, a few years later, writers characterized DEC quite differently. Digital Equipment Corporation is a company in need of triage. Sales are drying up in its key mini-computer line. A 2-year-old restructuring plan has failed miserably. Forecasting and production planning systems have failed miserably. Cost-cutting hasn't come close to restoring profitability. But the real misfortune may be DEC's lost opportunities. It has squandered 2 years trying halfway measures to respond to the low-margin personal computers and workstations that have transformed the computer industry. In Digital's case, as in Sears, the very decisions that led to its decline were made at the time it was so widely regarded as being an astutely managed firm. It was praised as a paragon of managerial excellence at the very time it was ignoring the arrival of the desktop computers that besieged it a few years later. Sears and Digital are in noteworthy company. Xerox long dominated the market for plain paper photocopiers used in large, high-volume copying centers. Yet, it missed huge growth and profit opportunities in the market for small tabletop photocopiers, where it became only a minor player. Although steel mini mills have now captured 40% of the North American steel market, including nearly all of the region's markets for bars, rods, and structural steel, not a single integrated steel company, American, Asian, or European, had by 1995 built a plant using mini mill technology. Of the 30 manufacturers of cable-actuated power shovels, only 4 survived the industry's 25-year transition to hydraulic excavation technology. As we shall see, the list of leading companies that failed when confronted with disruptive changes in technology and market structure is a long one. At first glance, there seems to be no pattern in the changes that overtook them. In some cases, the new technologies swept through quickly. In others, the transition took decades. In some, the new technologies were complex and expensive to develop. In others, the deadly technologies were simple extensions of what the leading companies already did better than anyone else. One theme common to all of these failures, however, is that the decisions that led to failure were made when the leaders in question were widely regarded as among the best companies in the world. There are 2 ways to resolve this paradox. One might be to conclude that firms such as Digital, IBM, Apple, Sears, Xerox, and Bucyrus Erie must never have been well managed. Maybe they were successful because of good luck and fortuitous timing, rather than good management. Maybe they finally fell on hard times because their good fortune ran out. Maybe. An alternative explanation, however, is that these failed firms were as well run as one could expect a firm managed by mortals to be, but that there is something about the way decisions get made in successful organizations that sows the seeds of eventual failure. The research reported in this book supports this latter view. It shows that in the cases of well-managed firms, such as those cited above, good management was the most powerful reason they failed to stay atop their industries. Precisely because these firms listened to their customers, invested aggressively in new technologies that would provide their customers more and better products of the sort they wanted, and because they carefully studied market trends and systematically allocated investment capital to innovations that promised the best returns, they lost their positions of leadership. What this implies at a deeper level is that many of what are now widely accepted principles of good management are in fact only situationally appropriate. There are times at which it is right not to listen to customers, right to invest in developing lower performance products that promise lower margins, and right to aggressively pursue small rather than substantial markets. This book derives a set of rules from carefully designed research and analysis of innovative successes and failures in the disk drive and other industries that managers can use to judge when the widely accepted principles of good management should be followed and when alternative principles are appropriate. These rules, which I call principles of disruptive innovation, show that when good companies fail, it often has been because their managers either ignored these principles or chose to fight them. Managers can be extraordinarily effective in managing even the most difficult innovations if they work to understand and harness the principles of disruptive innovation. As in many of life's most challenging endeavors, there is great value in coming to grips with the way the world works, and in managing innovative efforts in ways that accommodate such forces. The Innovator's Dilemma is intended to help a wide range of managers, consultants, and academics in manufacturing and service businesses, high tech or low, in slowly evolving or rapidly changing environments. Given that aim, technology, as used in this book, means the processes by which an organization transforms labor, capital, materials, and information into products and services of greater value. All firms have technologies. A retailer like Sears employs a particular technology to procure, present, sell, and deliver products to its customers, while a discount warehouse retailer like Price Costco employs a different technology. This concept of technology therefore extends beyond engineering and manufacturing to encompass a range of marketing, investment, and managerial processes. Innovation refers to a change in one of these technologies. The Dilemma. To establish the theoretical depth of the ideas in this book, the breadth of their usefulness, and their applicability to the future as well as the past, I have divided this book into two parts. Part 1, chapters 1 through 4, builds a framework that explains why sound decisions by great managers can lead firms to failure. The picture these chapters paint is truly that of an innovator's dilemma, the logical, competent decisions of management that are critical to the success of their companies are also the reasons why they lose their positions of leadership. Part 2, chapters 5 through 10, works to resolve the dilemma. Building on our understanding of why and under what circumstances new technologies have caused great firms to fail, it prescribes managerial solutions to the dilemma, how executives can simultaneously do what is right for the near-term health of their established businesses, while focusing adequate resources on the disruptive technologies that ultimately could lead to their downfall. Building a failure framework. I begin this book by digging deep before extending the discussion to draw general conclusions. The first two chapters recount in some detail the history of the disk drive industry, where the saga of good companies hitting hard times has been played out over and over again. This industry is an ideal field for studying failure because rich data about it exists, and because, in the words of Harvard Business School Dean Kim B. Clark, it is fast history. In just a few years, market segments, companies, and technologies have emerged, matured, and declined. Only twice in the six times that new architectural technologies have emerged in this field has the industry's dominant firm maintained its lead in the subsequent generation. This repetitive pattern of failure in the disk drive industry allowed me first to develop a preliminary framework that explained why the best and largest firms in the early generations of this industry failed, and then to test this framework across subsequent cycles in the industry's history to see whether it was robust enough to continue to explain failures among the industry's more recent leaders. Chapters 3 and 4 then deepen our understanding of why the leading firms stumbled repeatedly in the disk drive industry, and simultaneously test the breadth of the framework's usefulness by examining the failure of firms in industries with very different characteristics. Hence, Chapter 3, Exploring the Mechanical Excavator Industry, finds that the same factors that precipitated the failure of the leading disk drive makers also proved to be the undoing of the leading makers of mechanical excavators, in an industry that moves with a very different pace and technological intensity. Chapter 4 completes the framework and uses it to show why integrated steel companies worldwide have proven so incapable of blunting the attacks of the mini-mill steelmakers. Why good management can lead to failure. The failure framework is built upon three findings from this study. The first is that there is a strategically important distinction between what I call sustaining technologies and those that are disruptive. These concepts are very different from the incremental versus radical distinction that has characterized many studies of this problem. Second, the pace of technological progress can, and often does, outstrip what markets need. This means that the relevance and competitiveness of different technological approaches can change with respect to different markets over time. And third, customers and financial structures of successful companies color heavily the sorts of investments that appear to be attractive to them, relative to certain types of entering firms. Sustaining versus disruptive technologies. Most new technologies foster improved product performance. I call these sustaining technologies. Some sustaining technologies can be discontinuous or radical in character, while others are of an incremental nature. What all sustaining technologies have in common is that they improve the performance of established products, along the dimensions of performance that mainstream customers in major markets have historically valued. Most technological advances in a given industry are sustaining in character. An important finding revealed in this book is that rarely have even the most radically difficult sustaining technologies precipitated the failure of leading firms. Occasionally, however, disruptive technologies emerge, innovations that result in worse product performance, at least in the near term. Ironically, in each of the instances studied in this book, it was disruptive technology that precipitated the leading firm's failure. Disruptive technologies bring to a market a very different value proposition than had been available previously. Generally, disruptive technologies underperform established products in mainstream markets, but they have other features that a few fringe and generally new customers value. Products based on disruptive technologies are typically cheaper, simpler, smaller, and frequently more convenient to use. There are many examples, in addition to the personal desktop computer and discount retailing examples cited above. Small off-road motorcycles introduced in North America and Europe by Honda, Kawasaki, and Yamaha were disruptive technologies relative to the powerful over-the-road cycles made by Harley-Davidson and BMW. Transistors were disruptive technologies relative to vacuum tubes. Health maintenance organizations were disruptive technologies to conventional health insurers. In the near future, internet appliances may become disruptive technologies to suppliers of personal computer hardware and software. Trajectories of market need versus technology improvement. The second element of the failure framework, the observation that technologies can progress faster than market demand, means that in their efforts to provide better products than their competitors and earn higher prices and margins, suppliers often overshoot their market. They give customers more than they need or ultimately are willing to pay for. And more importantly, it means that disruptive technologies that may underperform today, relative to what users in the market demand, may be fully performance competitive in that same market tomorrow. Many who once needed mainframe computers for their data processing requirements, for example, no longer need or buy mainframes. Mainframe performance has surpassed the requirements of many original customers, who today find that much of what they need to do can be done on desktop machines linked to file servers. In other words, the needs of many computer users have increased more slowly than the rate of improvement provided by computer designers. Similarly, many shoppers who in 1965 felt they had to shop at department stores to be assured of quality and selection now satisfy those needs quite well at Target and Walmart. Disruptive technologies versus rational investments. The last element of the failure framework, the conclusion by established companies that investing aggressively in disruptive technologies is not a rational financial decision for them to make, has three bases. First, disruptive products are simpler and cheaper. They generally promise lower margins, not greater profits. Second, disruptive technologies typically are first commercialized in emerging or insignificant markets. And third, leading firms' most profitable customers generally don't want, and indeed initially can't use, products based on disruptive technologies. By and large, a disruptive technology is initially embraced by the least profitable customers in a market. Hence, most companies with a practiced discipline of listening to their best customers and identifying new products that promise greater profitability and growth are rarely able to build a case for investing in disruptive technologies until it is too late. Testing the failure framework. This book defines the problem of disruptive technologies and describes how they can be managed, taking care to establish what researchers call the internal and external validity of its propositions. Chapters 1 and 2 develop the failure framework in the context of the disk drive industry. And the initial pages of chapters 4 through 8 return to that industry to build a progressively deeper understanding of why disruptive technologies are such vexatious phenomena for good managers to confront successfully. The reason for painting such a complete picture of a single industry is to establish the internal validity of the failure framework. If a framework or model cannot reliably explain what happened within a single industry, it cannot be applied to other situations with confidence. Chapter 3 and the latter sections of chapters 4 through 9 are structured to explore the external validity of the failure framework, the conditions in which we might expect the framework to yield useful insights. Chapter 3 uses the framework to examine why the leading makers of cable excavators were driven from the earth-moving market by makers of hydraulic machines. And Chapter 4 discusses why the world's integrated steelmakers have floundered in the face of mini-mill technology. Chapter 5 uses the model to examine the success of discount retailers relative to conventional chain and department stores, and to probe the impact of disruptive technologies in the motor control and printer industries. Chapter 6 examines the emerging personal digital assistant industry and reviews how the electric motor control industry was upended by disruptive technology. Chapter 7 recounts how entrants using disruptive technologies in motorcycles and logic circuitry dethroned industry leaders. Chapter 8 shows how and why computer makers fell victim to disruption. And Chapter 9 spotlights the same phenomena in the accounting software and insulin businesses. Chapter 10 applies the framework to a case study of the electric vehicle, summarizing the lessons learned from the other industry studies, showing how they can be used to assess the opportunity and threat of electric vehicles, and describing how they might be applied to make an electric vehicle commercially successful. Chapter 11 summarizes the book's findings. Taken in sum, these chapters present a theoretically strong, broadly valid, and managerially practical framework for understanding disruptive technologies and how they have precipitated the fall from industry leadership of some of history's best managed companies. Harnessing the principles of disruptive innovation. Colleagues who have read my academic papers reporting the findings recounted in chapters 1 through 4 were struck by their near fatalism. If good management practice drives the failure of successful firms faced with disruptive technological change, then the usual answers to companies' problems, planning better, working harder, becoming more customer-driven, and taking a longer-term perspective, all exacerbate the problem. Sound execution, speed to market, total quality management, and process re-engineering are similarly ineffective. Needless to say, this is disquieting news to people who teach future managers. Chapters 5 through 10, however, suggest that although the solution to disruptive technologies cannot be found in the standard toolkit of good management, there are, in fact, sensible ways to deal effectively with this challenge. Every company in every industry works under certain forces, laws of organizational nature that acts powerfully to define what that company can and cannot do. Managers faced with disruptive technologies fail their companies when these forces overpower them. By analogy, the ancients who attempted to fly by strapping feathered wings to their arms and flapping with all their might as they leapt from high places invariably failed. Despite their dreams and hard work, they were fighting against some very powerful forces of nature. No one could be strong enough to win this fight. Flight became possible only after people came to understand the relevant natural laws and principles that defined how the world worked. The law of gravity, Bernoulli's principle, and the concepts of lift, drag, and resistance. When people then designed flying systems that recognized or harnessed the power of these laws and principles, rather than fighting them, they were finally able to fly to heights and distances that were previously unimaginable. The objective of chapters 5 through 10 is to propose the existence of five laws or principles of disruptive technology. As in the analogy with manned flight, these laws are so strong that managers who ignore or fight them are nearly powerless to pilot their companies through a disruptive technology storm. These chapters show, however, that if managers can understand and harness these forces, rather than fight them, they can in fact succeed spectacularly when confronted with disruptive technological change. I am particularly anxious that managers read these chapters for understanding rather than for simple answers. I am very confident that the great managers about whom this book is written will be very capable on their own of finding the answers that best fit their circumstances. But they must first understand what has caused those circumstances and what forces will affect the feasibility of their solutions. The following paragraphs summarize these principles and what managers can do to harness or accommodate them. Principle number one. Companies depend on customers and investors for resources. The history of the disk drive industry shows that the established firms stayed atop wave after wave of sustaining technologies, technologies that their customers needed, while consistently stumbling over simpler disruptive ones. This evidence supports the theory of resource dependence. Chapter 5 summarizes this theory, which states that while managers may think they control the flow of resources in their firms, in the end, it is really customers and investors who dictate how money will be spent, because companies with investment patterns that don't satisfy their customers and investors don't survive. The highest performing companies, in fact, are those that are the best at this. That is, they have well-developed systems for killing ideas that their customers don't want. As a result, these companies find it very difficult to invest adequate resources in disruptive technologies, lower margin opportunities that their customers don't want, until their customers want them. And by then, it is too late. Chapter 5 suggests a way for managers to align or harness this law with their efforts to confront disruptive technology. With few exceptions, the only instances in which mainstream firms have successfully established a timely position in a disruptive technology were those in which the firm's managers set up an autonomous organization charged with building a new and independent business around the disruptive technology. Such organizations, free of the power of the customers of the mainstream company, ensconce themselves among a different set of customers, those who want the products of the disruptive technology. In other words, companies can succeed in disruptive technologies when their managers align their organizations with the forces of resource dependence rather than ignoring or fighting them. The implication of this principle for managers is that when faced with a threatening disruptive technology, people and processes in a mainstream organization cannot be expected to allocate freely the critical financial and human resources needed to carve out a strong position in the small, emerging market. It is very difficult for a company whose cost structure is tailored to compete in high-end markets to be profitable in low-end markets as well. Creating an independent organization with a cost structure honed to achieve profitability at the low margins characteristic of most disruptive technologies, is the only viable way for established firms to harness this principle. Principle number two. Small markets don't solve the growth needs of large companies. Disruptive technologies typically enable new markets to emerge. There is strong evidence showing that companies entering these emerging markets early have significant first-mover advantages over later entrants. And yet, as these companies succeed and grow larger, it becomes progressively more difficult for them to enter the even newer small markets destined to become the large ones of the future. To maintain their share prices and create internal opportunities for employees to extend the scope of their responsibilities, successful companies need to continue to grow. But while a $40 million company needs to find just $8 million in revenues to grow at 20% in the subsequent year, a $4 billion company needs to find $800 million in new sales. No new markets are that large. As a consequence, the larger and more successful an organization becomes, the weaker the argument that emerging markets can remain useful engines for growth. Many large companies adopt a strategy of waiting until new markets are large enough to be interesting. But the evidence presented in Chapter 6 shows why this is not often a successful strategy. Those large established firms that have successfully seized strong positions in the new markets, enabled by disruptive technologies, have done so by giving responsibility to commercialize the disruptive technology to an organization whose size matched the size of the targeted market. Small organizations can most easily respond to the opportunities for growth in a small market. The evidence is strong that formal and informal resource allocation processes make it very difficult for large organizations to focus adequate energy and talent on small markets, even when logic says they might be big someday. Principle number three. Markets that don't exist can't be analyzed. Sound market research and good planning followed by execution, according to plan, are hallmarks of good management. When applied to sustaining technological innovation, these practices are invaluable. They are the primary reason, in fact, why established firms led in every single instance of sustaining innovation in the history of the disk drive industry. Such reasoned approaches are feasible in dealing with sustaining technology because the size and growth rates of the markets are generally known. Trajectories of technological progress have been established, and the needs of leading customers have usually been well articulated. Because the vast majority of innovations are sustaining in character, most executives have learned to manage innovation in a sustaining context, where analysis and planning were feasible. In dealing with disruptive technologies leading to new markets, however, market researchers and business planners have consistently dismal records. In fact, based upon the evidence from the disk drive, motorcycle, and microprocessor industries, reviewed in Chapter 7, the only thing we may know for sure when we read experts' forecasts about how large emerging markets will become is that they are wrong. In many instances, leadership in sustaining innovations, about which information is known and for which plans can be made, is not competitively important. In such cases, technology followers do about as well as technology leaders. It is in disruptive innovations, where we know least about the market, that there are such strong first-mover advantages. This is the innovator's dilemma. Companies whose investment processes demand quantification of market sizes and financial returns before they can enter a market get paralyzed or make serious mistakes when faced with disruptive technologies. They demand market data when none exists, and make judgments based upon financial projections when neither revenues or costs can, in fact, be known. Using planning and marketing techniques that were developed to manage sustaining technologies in the very different context of disruptive ones is an exercise in flapping wings. Chapter 7 discusses a different approach to strategy and planning that recognizes the law that the right markets, and the right strategy for exploiting them, cannot be known in advance. Called discovery-based planning, it suggests that managers assume that forecasts are wrong, rather than right, and that the strategy they have chosen to pursue may likewise be wrong. Investing and managing under such assumptions drives managers to develop plans for learning what needs to be known, a much more effective way to confront disruptive technologies successfully. Principle number 4. An organization's capabilities define its disabilities. When managers tackle an innovation problem, they instinctively work to assign capable people to the job. But once they've found the right people, too many managers then assume that the organization in which they'll work will also be capable of succeeding at the task. And that is dangerous, because organizations have capabilities that exist independently of the people who work within them. An organization's capabilities reside in two places. The first is in its processes, the methods by which people have learned to transform inputs of labor, energy, materials, information, cash, and technology into outputs of higher value. The second is in the organization's values, which are the criteria that managers and employees in the organization use when making prioritization decisions. People are quite flexible, in that they can be trained to succeed at quite different things. An employee of IBM, for example, can quite readily change the way he or she works in order to work successfully in a small startup company. But processes and values are not flexible. A process that is effective at managing the design of a mini computer, for example, would be ineffective at managing the design of a desktop personal computer. Similarly, values that cause employees to prioritize projects to develop high-margin products cannot simultaneously accord priority to low-margin products. The very processes and values that constitute an organization's capabilities in one context define its disabilities in another context. Chapter 8 will present a framework that can help a manager understand precisely where in his or her organization its capabilities and disabilities reside. Drawing on studies in the disk drive and computer industries, it offers tools that managers can use to create new capabilities when the processes and values of the present organization would render it incapable of successfully addressing a new problem. Principle number 5. Technology supply may not equal market demand. Disruptive technologies, though they initially can only be used in small markets remote from the mainstream, are disruptive because they subsequently can become fully performance competitive within the mainstream market against established products. One study shows that this happens because the pace of technological progress in products frequently exceeds the rate of performance improvement that mainstream customers demand or can absorb. As a consequence, products whose features and functionality closely match market needs today often follow a trajectory of improvement by which they overshoot mainstream market needs tomorrow. And products that seriously underperform today, relative to customer expectations in mainstream markets, may become directly performance competitive tomorrow. Chapter 9 shows that when this happens, in markets as diverse as disk drives, accounting software, and diabetes care, the basis of competition, the criteria by which customers choose one product over another, changes. When the performance of two or more competing products has improved beyond what the market demands, customers can no longer base their choice upon which is the higher performing product. The basis of product choice often evolves from functionality to reliability, then to convenience, and ultimately to price. Many students of business have described phases of the product life cycle in various ways, but Chapter 9 proposes that the phenomenon in which product performance overshoots market demands is the primary mechanism driving shifts in the phases of the product life cycle. In their efforts to stay ahead by developing competitively superior products, many companies don't realize the speed at which they are moving up market, oversatisfying the needs of their original customers as they race the competition toward higher performance, higher margin markets. In doing so, they create a vacuum at lower price points, into which competitors employing disruptive technologies can enter. Only those companies that carefully measure trends in how their mainstream customers use their products can catch the points at which the basis of competition will change in the markets they serve. Lessons for spotting disruptive threats and opportunities. Some managers and researchers familiar with these ideas have arrived at this point in the story in an anxious state because the evidence is very strong that even the best managers have stumbled badly when their markets were invaded by disruptive technologies. Most urgently, they want to know whether their own businesses are targets for an attacking disruptive technologist and how they can defend their business against such an attack before it is too late. Others, interested in finding entrepreneurial opportunities, wonder how they can identify potentially disruptive technologies around which new companies and markets can be built. Chapter 10 addresses these questions in a rather unconventional way. Rather than offering a checklist of questions to ask or analyses to perform, it creates a case study of a particularly vexing but well-known problem in technological innovation, the electric vehicle. Positioning myself in the role of protagonist, as the program manager responsible for electric vehicle development in a major automobile manufacturing company, wrestling with the mandate of the California Air Resources Board to begin selling electric vehicles in that state, I explore the question of whether electric vehicles are in fact a disruptive technology, and then suggest ways to organize this program, set its strategy, and manage it to succeed. In the spirit of all case studies, the purpose of this chapter is not to advance what I believe to be the correct answer to this innovator's challenge. Rather, it suggests a methodology and a way of thinking about the problem of managing disruptive technological change that should prove useful in many other contexts. Chapter 10 thus takes us deeply into the innovator's dilemma that good companies often begin their descent into failure by aggressively investing in the products and services that their most profitable customers want. No automotive company is currently threatened by electric cars, and none contemplates a wholesale leap into that arena. The automobile industry is healthy. Gasoline engines have never been more reliable. Never before has such high performance and quality been available at such low prices. Indeed, aside from governmental mandates, there is no reason why we should expect the established car makers to pursue electric vehicles. But the electric car is a disruptive technology and potential future threat. The innovator's task is to ensure that this innovation, the disruptive technology that doesn't make sense, is taken seriously within the company without putting at risk the needs of present customers who provide profit and growth. As Chapter 10 concretely lays out, the problem can be resolved only when new markets are considered and carefully developed around new definitions of value, and when responsibility for building the business is placed within a focused organization whose size and interest are carefully aligned with the unique needs of the market's customers. Where disruptions are happening today. One of the most gratifying aspects of my life since the first edition of The Innovator's Dilemma was published has been the number of people who have called, representing industries that I had never thought about, who have suggested that forces similar to those historical examples I described in these pages are disrupting their industries as well. Not surprisingly, the Internet looms as an infrastructural technology that is enabling the disruption of many industries. My hope is that the future might be different than the past. I believe that the future can be different if managers will recognize these disruptions for what they are and address them in a way that accounts for or harnesses the fundamental principles described soon. Part 1. Why Great Companies Can Fail. Chapter 1. How Can Great Firms Fail? Insights from the Hard Disk Drive Industry. When I began my search for an answer to the puzzle of why the best firms can fail, a friend offered some sage advice. Those who study genetics avoid studying humans, he noted. Because new generations come along only every 30 years or so, it takes a long time to understand the cause and effect of any changes. Instead, they study fruit flies, because they are conceived, born, mature, and die, all within a single day. If you want to understand why something happens in business, study the disk drive industry. Those companies are the closest things to fruit flies that the business world will ever see. Indeed, nowhere in the history of business has there been an industry like disk drives, where changes in technology, market structure, global scope, and vertical integration have been so pervasive, rapid, and unrelenting. While this pace and complexity might be a nightmare for managers, my friend was right about its being fertile ground for research. Few industries offer researchers the same opportunities for developing theories about how different types of change cause certain types of firms to succeed or fail, or for testing those theories as the industry repeats its cycles of change. This chapter summarizes the history of the disk drive industry in all its complexity. Some readers will be interested in it for the sake of history itself. But the value of understanding this history is that out of its complexity emerge a few stunningly simple and consistent factors that have repeatedly determined the success and failure of the industry's best firms. Simply put, when the best firms succeeded, they did so because they listened responsively to their customers and invested aggressively in the technology, products, and manufacturing capabilities that satisfied their customers' next-generation needs. But, paradoxically, when the best firms subsequently failed, it was for the same reasons. They listened responsively to their customers and invested aggressively in the technology, products, and manufacturing capabilities that satisfied their customers' next-generation needs. This is one of the innovator's dilemmas. Blindly following the maxim that good managers should keep close to their customers can sometimes be a fatal mistake. The history of the disk drive industry provides a framework for understanding when keeping close to your customers is good advice and when it is not. The robustness of this framework could only be explored by researching the industry's history in careful detail. Some of that detail is recounted here and elsewhere in this book, in the hope that readers who are immersed in the detail of their own industries will be better able to recognize how similar patterns have affected their own fortunes and those of their competitors. How disk drives work. Disk drives write and read information that computers use. They comprise read-write heads mounted at the end of an arm that swings over the surface of a rotating disk, in much the same way that a phonograph needle and arm reach over a record. Aluminum or glass disks coated with magnetic material, at least two electric motors, a spin motor that drives the rotation of the disks, and an actuator motor that moves the head to the desired position over the disk, and a variety of electronic circuits that control the drive's operation and its interface with the computer. The read-write head is a tiny electromagnet whose polarity changes whenever the direction of the electrical current running through it changes. Because opposite magnetic poles attract, when the polarity of the head becomes positive, the polarity of the area on the disk beneath the head switches to negative, and vice versa. By rapidly changing the direction of current flowing through the head's electromagnet, as the disk spins beneath the head, a sequence of positively and negatively oriented magnetic domains are created in concentric tracks on the disk's surface. Disk drives can use the positive and negative domains on the disk as a binary numeric system, 1 and 0, to write information onto disks. Drives read information from disks in essentially the opposite process. Changes in the magnetic flux fields on the disk surface induce changes in the microcurrent flowing through the head. Emergence of the earliest disk drives. A team of researchers at IBM's San Jose Research Laboratories developed the first disk drive between 1952 and 1956. Named RAMAC, for Random Access Method for Accounting and Control, this drive was the size of a large refrigerator, incorporated 50 24-inch disks, and could store 5 megabytes of information. Most of the fundamental architectural concepts and component technologies that defined today's dominant disk drive design were also developed at IBM. These include its removable packs of rigid disks, introduced in 1961, the floppy disk drive, 1971, and the Windows